Welcome to the Ecclesia Hollywood podcast.
I was out for a walk the end of this last week on one of the trails, and here were about five women giggling and hugging each other, and the sixth woman was standing on a boulder in front of them, and she had the ocean as a backdrop, and she had her cell phone out, and she was clearly taking their photo, and they were giggling, and she was trying to get them to all get inside the frame of the photo, and I walked by. And I just said to the gal standing on the boulder, I said, would you like to be in the photo as well? And she looked at me very happy. Oh, yes, yes, these are my friends. And so she jumped down, and we got them all in the picture, and I managed to take a photo with an iPhone and not mess it up. You'll probably see it on a billboard now in the next few weeks, taken with an iPhone 6. Shot with an iPhone 6. But she wanted, they all wanted to hang on to a photo of all of them together. So clearly they were friends, and this meant something to them. They weren't just casually strolling along. There were connections that they had with each other. And that's what we look at today as we continue in this series of seeing God's perspective on life, especially life in L.A. And we're using David's own life to extract some wisdom from God for us, to shed some light on the ups and downs and sometimes chaos of life here in L.A. for each of us. We look today at the whole place of friendship and relationship. And I'd like to have you participate, because it feels a little weird to me to talk about friendship, and I'm talking, and a bunch of people are just listening. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you to turn, and with maybe three or at most four people around you, answer a question, which in some ways is quite simple. And that's good, because you don't have 20 minutes each to talk. But I want you to, before we do that, I want you to think about someone who's a significant friend in your life. Could be long ago, could be right now. You get to pick. And you don't have time to tell us who they are. You don't have time to tell us how you grew into this wonderful friendship. But here's the question I want you to comment on when you're in your group, and that is, what effect have they had on you? How have they rubbed off on, influenced? How are you a better and different person because of the friendship you had with whoever that person might be? And maybe take 30, 60 seconds each to offer that comment. If when you turn to a couple of people around you, you don't know someone, just say, my name's Paul, tell me your name, and then get right to it. We have maybe 3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes to do this, so don't dominate the whole time. Try to keep it under a minute. What effect, what influence has that friend that you're imagining, picturing in your mind, had on you? Okay, the next 3 or 4 minutes is yours. Circle up and enjoy hearing from each other. Sounds like lots of good conversation. It's really fun to hear the chatter in the room. Thank you. Okay. So think about this. In the beginning, does that bring back any memories? In the beginning, it's how the Bible starts. Book of Genesis, first verse, first chapter. In the beginning, and then it goes on to say God created. And as Genesis, the first two chapters, traces creation, as God is the artist and author of that, after each significant thing God creates, there's a phrase in Genesis, and it says, God saw what he just created, and he said, it's good. Everything God created, he kept saying, that's good, that's good, that's good. Except when God creates Adam, for the first time, you get the phrase, it's not good. And he didn't mean, uh-oh, I messed up on people. But what he went on and he explained, it's not good for man to be alone. And so then he creates women as well. But that verse says a lot more than just a verse about marriage. It really is speaking about the human makeup. If you and I could be okay just having a faith in Jesus, our Bible, we could sit and worship anywhere. We could do the Christian life by ourselves. You wouldn't have to get in your car. You wouldn't have to get up. You could go to the beach, go to the mountains, just stay in your living room. And yet, whenever I've met people who are followers of Christ that are not in relationship with other believers, invariably they're discouraged, confused, or losing oomph in their Christian walk. It's not good for us to be alone. In fact, the statistics say, just thinking for a moment about church itself, that 76% of people nationally surveyed when asked the question, why do you stay in the church you're at? 76%, that's 3 out of every 4 people, say relationships, which is rather humbling for those of us who preach for a living or lead worship or man children's ministries. In fact, I think the preaching was in single digits. It's like, yeah, 7 or 8% stay for the preaching. But 76%, it's for the human connection. And when they don't get it, they don't stay. But this isn't a sermon about staying at church. But our very name is Ecclesia, which means called out ones, but it means called out together, not called out privately and alone. And it seems to me, at least, you know, in my life as well as in the pastoral work that I have the privilege of doing, that what I bump into time and again, and I know it's true for me as well, is almost at the core of who we are as human beings is this desire to be known and accepted, ideally loved, but wanting to be, to know, do you accept me? And that creates a push and a pull within us because that's a quest. On the other hand, it's a fear because what if, as you get to know me, you don't accept me? What if you reject me? What if instead of loving me, you make fun of me or dismiss me or all of that? So inherent in relationships is risk. We need them. And yet, there's no guarantee that they're all going to go well or that they'll all meet the need we have or the expectation we hope they'll fulfill. Easy for me. The two most painful experiences and memories in my life were both from best friends. They didn't set out to do that, but they were my deepest friends at those points in my life. And yet the things that happened ended up being as painful, and I'm sure that's partly why it was so painful, because this came from someone that I thought was my very best friend. And you've probably had similar happen to you. Some friendships are slow. They progressively develop. I've mentioned before, when I'm home, I either connect in person, except when we were traveling. We met every Friday morning, John and I. That started by 13 years ago, my saying, my schedule's getting kind of wacky. I need someone that is a regular rhythm in my life that's a significant friend. But I wasn't sure if it would be John, and so I said, would you like to go to coffee one time? And we talked, and I said, I have a need in my life for this, but I don't want to make you have to meet my need. And he said, you know, I share that same need. And so we said, let's just meet for a while and see how it goes. And progressively, that relationship kept deepening and deepening and deepening. And so we've been doing that for 13 years, and when one of us is out of town like I am now, he sent me a lengthy email Friday, breathing fresh second wind into me, even though he's 2,000 miles away. And over the course of those 13 years, we've done, you name it, we've experienced it, and we've walked through it together. Cancer on his wife's side, job loss, personal trauma, family crises, financial crises, everything on the list. But neither of us went through it alone. And we both know we can whine and cry and be weak in front of each other, and the other guy's not going to go, ooh, I don't want to be your friend anymore. But that built progressively. Other friendships, we'll see an example of it today in our passage, instant bonding, almost inexplicable, just a heart knitting that happened just like that. So they come in a variety of forms. Some of them even surprise us. Never thought I'd be friends with that person, and yet look what's forming and look what's evolving here. But it's not good for us to be alone. So we have this contradiction inside of us. I really want it, and I'm afraid if I pursue it, what if it doesn't pan out, or what if I get hurt in the process? Yeah. But the price tag for avoiding getting hurt is even worse, which is isolation or living on the surface. So we're looking in this series at seeing God's perspective, trying to understand God's perspective on doing life, especially for us, life in LA, and taking David's life as our roadmap. And today we come to that rare type of deep, impactful friendship between David and Jonathan. I'd invite you to turn to 1 Samuel 19. I have to start in 18 to get us there. And if you're using that Bible in front of you, I can make it easier for you. It's page 200. And we'll move through several different sections in Scripture, but all of them are held together by the thread of David and Jonathan's relationship. So David is the golden boy of the hour. He's killed Goliath. The nation is singing songs about him. And Saul is starting to become paranoid. The king, Saul, is starting to distrust David and believe people are shifting loyalty to David, and David's going to end up becoming king instead of my own family maintaining the throne. Saul's son and heir apparent is Jonathan, so Jonathan would be next in line to become king, succeeding Saul. And that brings us to 1 Samuel chapter 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David. He loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his own family. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Second time we hear that phrase. Jonathan even took off his royal robe, which was the sign of being part of the royal family, and he gave it to David. He also gave him his tunic, his sword, his bow, and his belt. In other words, he's handing over and acknowledging that David is going to be the next king, not Jonathan. Jonathan is voluntarily letting go of power so that David can elevate. That right there is a rare commodity in a friend. The word used twice in this passage, when it twice says that Jonathan loved David and they had this instant bond, there's some Hebrew language stuff going on that's helpful. It's the Hebrew word ahav. And it means bond, it means connection. This isn't suggesting, just so we clarify the English, it's not suggesting that they had some kind of a same-sex relationship. That would be a different word, yada, that's not used here. But there is this deep bond that's formed between the two of them. And it seems that Jonathan, it's getting there faster for Jonathan. And that moves us to 1 Samuel 20. Now, what's happening between chapter 18, where their initial bond is cementing, and chapter 20 is David being the popular national hero. Suddenly, that's turning upside down on him, and Saul has become paranoid and has twice tried to kill David, and he will keep it up for the rest of Saul's life, trying to kill David. And so now David has gone from being the popular guy to being the guy that he's not sure if anything is safe. He's convinced that his relationship with Saul is not safe. So is his relationship with Saul's son safe? Not sure. So David decides to have a conversation that's pretty blunt and direct with his friend Jonathan to find out if this friendship is starting to fade. And that takes us to chapter 20. We want to get to 3 and 4, but let me read 1 and 2 first. David fled from Naioth at Ramah. He went to Jonathan and he asked him this: "What have I done? What's my crime? How have I wronged your father? He's trying to kill me." To which Jonathan replied, "Never. You're not going to die. My father doesn't do anything great or small without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so." And the answer to Jonathan's question, he went too quickly to "it isn't so." But when he says, "Why would he hide this from me?" You know why he would hide it from you? Because Saul knows Jonathan and David have a deep friendship. And Saul's not going to tell his son, "I hate David and I'm planning to kill him." Because he knows they've got this friendship. And that's basically what David now says to Jonathan in verse 3 and 4. David took an oath, and he said, "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes." He said to himself, "Jonathan must not know this." And the "this" is that Saul wants to kill David. "Or else Jonathan would be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there's only a step between me and death." And Jonathan said to David, and boy, this is a friend, isn't it? You don't get too many of these in life. "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you." Blank check. One of my dear friends, Dick, we went to graduate school together. He settled in Colorado, and I ended up settling in Minneapolis. But we stay in touch. We vacationed together. We do fun and cheer each other up, and we talk straight to each other when the other one needs a kick in the pants. And I remember I was in Minneapolis, and the phone rang. And it's Dick. And he's kind of quiet, which is unusual. Usually he's kind of squirrely. And he said to me, he said, "My mom died." I'd never met his mom. She lived in Carolina. And then it was just quiet on the end of the phone, and I wasn't quite sure, why would you call me and tell me your mom died, a mom I never met? And I waited, and Dick said, "So I'm thinking of coming up to Minneapolis." Well, and then it all made sense. What he's saying is, I've just had a big loss in my life, and I've got to be able to be with a friend. I said, "Dick, you just tell me when you're coming. I'll clear my schedule." Because he's on the short list of my closest friends, and here's Jonathan saying, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it." What must that have meant to David, who knows that Saul's trying to kill him, who knows Jonathan is Saul's son, and who's not sure if the relationship with Jonathan is still trustworthy or if Jonathan is now lining up with his father against David, and to have Jonathan say, "You just tell me, I'll do whatever you want me to do." Well, that launches them into a conversation. Basically, David says, "I need to know if my fears are legitimate, that Saul truly is trying to kill me, or if I'm safe and it's okay for me to stick around." And in those days, the king would have certain people who ate at his table. It wasn't optional. If you got invited to eat at the king's table, you didn't decline. You were expected to be there. David was one of those who now ate at Saul's table. Certainly Jonathan, being the son, was at the table, and then there would be others. And so what they come up with is David says, "I'm going to be absent." We'd call it an unexcused absence from the king's table, potentially insulting and offensive to the king. But David said, "I'll absent myself from the king's dinner table. And when Saul asks, why is David's seat empty? Where is David? Jonathan can offer the answer. He's gone. He's traveling. He asks King Saul's understanding, but he's away." And what they conclude is, if Saul, you know, doesn't care, really, then it means Saul's not all worked up and it's safe for David to stick around. On the other hand, if Saul has a strong reaction, then that's the signal that he really does intend to kill David, and then David's going to have to run for his life. And so that's what they come up with. But in the midst of that little sort of secret way of discovering what Saul's true heart attitude is, you have this chunk in 1 Samuel 20, verse 12 through 15. And Jonathan says to David, "I swear by the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he's favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? And if my father intends to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, Jonathan, be it ever so severely, if I don't let you know that also. And I realize that means I have to send you away. And I would send you away in peace. May the Lord be with you as he's been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness, like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And don't ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of your enemies from the face of the earth." Verse 16 says, "So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. The friendship deepens even further. So David absents himself from the king's table for a period of time. The first night, Saul notices his absence, and it's no big deal, which probably spiked hopes for Jonathan that, see, my father's not angry at David. It's going to be okay. I bet I can go signal David. He can come back. And the second night of David's absence from the meal, Saul starts probing and wanting to know, why is David absent? And so just like they planned, Jonathan speaks and explains David's absence and waits to see Saul's reaction. And reaction would be an understatement. So look at it in verse 30 through 33 of 1 Samuel 20. Saul's anger flared up, and this is his own son, flares up at his own son Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. Can you do the translation on that? He's saying this to his own son. You son of a bitch. I mean, anger is just exploding out of Saul at this point. He's going to ream his son there at the dinner table in front of other people. Don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse, that's David, to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me so he can die. Pretty clear what Saul's attitude is. And he blows up right there at the dinner table, and everybody sees it. And Jonathan pushes back because he knows what this means. If Saul stays locked into this attitude, then David's got to run for his life. And Jonathan loses a deep friend. So he tries to bring his dad to reason. Good luck on that one. Verse 32, why should he be put to death? What has he done in Jonathan as he asks his father? And so Saul grabs his spear and hurls it at his very son, trying to kill him. And then Jonathan knew that his father's intention was to kill David. Verse 34 says, Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger, and on the second day of the feast didn't eat because he was grieved at how his father had shamefully treated David in public. Probably shaken by how his father had treated him as well, and even thrown a spear and tried to kill him. And so now that means Jonathan, as the faithful, committed friend, must signal the message to David he doesn't want to deliver. That your worst fears are true. My dad's out to kill you. That you've got to leave. You've got to get out of here. They had arranged, you can read about it for yourself in this chapter, but basically David was going to hide behind a big rock. Jonathan was going to shoot some arrows. He had a servant boy with him, and depending where the arrows went, he would tell the servant boy, run a certain direction or the other. And if he told him, run this way, it meant, David, you're safe. All's well, you can come. If he told the servant boy, run a different direction, then it meant, you're not safe. Sadly, it's true, my father wants to kill you. And so that's what Jonathan signals as he shoots the arrows and sends the servant boy to gather them. And then you come to verse 41 and 42. Of 1 Samuel 20, after the servant boy had collected the arrows and left, David gets up from the south side of the stone he'd been hiding behind. And David, the guy who killed Goliath, David, the hero, at least had been, of the nation, David, the guy anointed by Samuel to become the next king, David bows 3 times to the ground in front of Jonathan. Oh, my friend, you've taken great risk and you've saved my life. Three times he bows before Jonathan with his face to the ground, and then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Because he had to part and be separated from Jonathan, maybe, but I think he's moved significantly by this act of risk and friendship that Jonathan has demonstrated. I wonder, when David was hiding behind that rock and Jonathan came out to shoot the arrows with the prearranged signals, how much did it run through David's mind? What if Jonathan really is going to trap me and sell me down the river on this deal? What if he shoots the arrows too, and then when I emerge and we talk, there's a bunch of the king's guards and they're going to grab me, because then Jonathan can become king. And so a friendship plumbs new depths when David realizes, I'm safe with this guy and he's taking great risk to keep me safe. He's giving David the gift of his own life, survival. And that begins David's life on the run. Even outside the borders of Israel, feigning madness, as we saw last week, sometimes living in caves and running through the desert, hiding wherever he can, sometimes living in cities of refuge, and then finding out the city has already ratted him out to Saul, and so he's about to get handed over by the people he thought he was safe with. Sometimes you think you're safe with people, and then you find out you're not. And that's David's life for the next 8 years. There's a point in all of that. I'll just read it for you. It's kind of a sweet little chunk. 1 Samuel 23, David, this life on the run wears you out. Not just physically, but the stress of knowing Saul, who has great resources, is hunting him and intends to kill him. And in his great weariness in chapter 23, verse 15 to 18, it says, while David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned Saul yet again had come out to take his life. This is getting so tiring. Am I ever going to survive this? Who's going to protect me? The fatigue of it all, the anxiety of it all. And it says in verse 16, and Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. Jonathan shows up again. He says to David, don't be afraid. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel. I'll be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this. The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. And then Jonathan went home. And David remained at Horesh. It's the last time, biblically, that we know of that they ever see each other. It doesn't play out the way Jonathan predicts. He doesn't become second to David. He'll die with Saul at the end of 1 Samuel. They die in battle. In the first chapter of 2 Samuel, David writes a national song of mourning, and he talks about how the heroes have died on the mountains. But then he pays special tribute to Jonathan, not just to his warrior abilities, but to his friendship. And he puts it into a song the whole nation learns to sing. I remember years ago, one of my best friends, his mother passed away, and she had chosen to be cremated, and so her remains were in an urn, and she was going to be put into the niche, that's what they call it, in the wall, right out here at Forest Lawn. And I said to him, I said, do you want somebody to go with you? And at first he said no. And then the phone rang again a half hour later, and he said, did you mean it? I said, yeah. He said, okay, why don't you come with me? And so here we are sitting in two folding chairs outdoors at Forest Lawn. I remember hearing the traffic going by, staring at this huge marble wall with all these little title plates on them and one wedged open with an urn with his mother's remains staring at us, just the two of us. And I'm sitting there and I'm just seized with anxiety. I'm his best friend. And I'm his pastor. I got to think of something to say. He's in agony. He's sitting this far from me. We're staring at this wall of death. So my mind started to say, well, say this. And then I thought, well, no. That might not be helpful. Depends how he takes it. No, don't say that. So I said nothing. And then I thought, well, how about a Bible verse? You're a pastor. Give him a verse. And I thought, well, how about this verse? Well, no, maybe. I don't know. And so I'm scrolling through Bible verses. Nothing comes out of my mouth. Nothing. Not even an audible burp. And we're sitting there, and I'm feeling like I have so failed my friend. And then he starts talking about his mother as he stares at the wall. Paul, I miss her so much. She was such a mom. And he starts going on and appreciating his mother, and pretty soon he's crying, and his tears are trickling down his beard, and I'm crying because he's crying, plus I'm crying because I'm thinking I'm really failing as a friend. And he's crying and remembering his mother and talking about the heartache of missing her. And then next sentence, he's into prayer and he's praying, but Lord, I know she's with you and I know I'll see her again someday. And I miss her and it hurts, but there's that hope. And so, Lord, I'm thankful, but I'm so sad and I'm hurting and I miss my mom, but I'll see her again. And he's praying and he's crying and I'm speechless. And then eventually he stops praying and we stare at the wall for a while. And I don't know how long went by. Felt like a really long time to me. And then he looked at me and he says, okay, let's go. And we get in the car and start to drive back. And I looked at him, I said, Kent, I failed you. I so wanted to be helpful, and I just, nothing seemed right. I wasn't sure what to say, so I said nothing. I just feel horrible. And I'll never forget, he looked at me and he said, no, Paul, he said, you were here. You were here. You didn't need to say anything, which is a good thing, because I said nothing. But what he was saying was presence spoke so much. Friends show up. Spent an hour on the phone Friday with a friend who lives in a different part of the country, and he, like Jonathan, his words were keeping me on my feet. It's fabulous. He's clear on the East Coast. It was a gift to me. A few weeks back, as I was driving in here for Sunday morning, it was Easter Sunday morning, and for a variety of reasons, as I was driving, I said, Lord, I don't ask it very often, but would you encourage me this morning? And not something that is an obvious, easy encouragement. Would you send me some kind of an unexpected surprise encouragement that I couldn't have seen coming, couldn't have scripted? That'd just be really nice. So Easter services end, and SR, remember SR? He was in first service. Comes up to me and hands me an Easter card. The only Easter card I got on Easter. By the way, don't hear that as, oh, I should have gotten Pastor Paul an Easter card. I'm just saying. I got one from SR, and I opened it. Can't really remember what the card said, but I can tell you the handwritten note SR put in there. I thought, oh, Lord, wow. I wouldn't have scripted this. On the drive-in, it didn't occur to me, okay, so, Lord, I'm praying SR would give me a card with a personal note. And there it was. God providing just what I needed, but it came through somebody. For 5 years after Saul and Jonathan die in battle, David still has civil war raging because there's parts of the nation of Israel who still want to stay loyal to Saul and they want to have their own guy as king. And so they're fighting and opposing David, and it takes 5 years to sift and sort and fight through that. And then you get to 2 Samuel 9, and finally the nation has unified around David. They've accepted him as their king, and he's got stability, relatively speaking. He's got peace. It's one of the times when the stress meter is going down, one of those rare times in David's life. And you get this interesting, strange thing that happens in 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1. Now at peace, with his kingship solidified, David asks a question in 2 Samuel 9, verse 1. He says, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Huh. This friendship was so significant that David says, can I show love and care to anybody in Jonathan's family, even though Jonathan's gone? I get that. You get that. One of our dear friends who lived across the street from us died wickedly of cancer at age 38. One of my dear friends in life. His wife doesn't use the front door. She just walks right in the back door, doesn't have to knock. And we like her. But for the rest of our life, Laura can walk in anytime she wants because of John. We'll do that for John. Gladly. And that's what David's got going. He's saying, is there anybody left? I made a commitment to Jonathan that we would not just be friends with each other, but we'd look out for each other's families. Is there anybody left? Now, asking that question sounds nice. In Near Eastern culture at that time, that question was asked by kings who solidified control for a different reason. Because you want to kill off everybody who's in any way related to the former king. Because otherwise, they're going to mount some kind of a rebellion at some point. So David asked the question, and you can't fault the one remaining relative, a guy named Mephibosheth. There's a name that just rolls off your tongue for you. Try spelling that. Throw that at somebody in Trivial Pursuit. You'll probably win because they won't be able to spell it. And so the answer comes back, well, Jonathan had one son, but he was dropped as a child, and so he's disabled. He's lame in both feet. His name's Mephibosheth. And so in verse 5 and verse 6, David says, where is he? And they say at the end of verse 4, well, Mephibosheth is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lo-Debar. Lo-Debar means not a place. If we were translating it to English, the best translation would be, this guy lives in Nowheresville. What's he doing in Nowheresville? He's hiding for fear that if David starts asking about relatives of Saul or Jonathan, I'm going to be killed. So he's in Lo-Debar. And David says, bring him. Can you imagine being Mephibosheth? Oh, no. He found me even in Lo-Debar. And so here comes, disabled, unable to walk, Mephibosheth. And he appears before David. Verse 6, of course, Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, comes to David, and he bows down to pay him honor. Yeah, I bet he did. And David says, Mephibosheth, and he says, at your service. You just hear him quaking in that, and David says, don't be afraid. I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather, the king, Saul, and he had a lot of it. And you will always eat at my table. And Mephibosheth still isn't sure if this is just the cute talk before they kill me. And so in verse 8, he says, well, what is your servant that you should notice me? I'm like a dead dog. Like, just ignore me. I'm nothing. I won't cause you any trouble. But the king calls the servant Ziba, and he says, I've given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm that land for him. Bring in the crops so your master's grandson may be provided for, and Mephibosheth, grandson of your master and son of my dear friend Jonathan, will always eat at my table. Isn't that interesting that Saul wanted to kill David and eliminate him from his table, and now David invites Saul's grandson to be at my table because Jonathan had such an effect on my life. So the last verse of the chapter just matter-of-factly tells us something that is just freighted with emotion. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. He's highly vulnerable, and David shows him kindness because of the influence Jonathan had on David's life. Don't do life alone. Don't even do life with superficial, surface, quick hit-and-run relationships. And I know there's a risk. Might get hurt. Yeah, but the other risk is if you don't engage in significant relationships, you're alone. And that's a lot harder. I can recite for you the list of the people that are in my personal, I don't like the phrase, but I'll use it, Hall of Fame. Friends that if the phone rings tomorrow, I don't have to say, what do you need? I'll just say, whatever you need, I'll do it. Because they have so given themselves to my life when I had need that it's definitely a David Jonathan kind of thing. And you've probably got your own list, and that list hopefully is growing. Thank them. They may not even know how significant they are in your life. Maybe your walk-away takeaway today is to just say, I want to express a thank you to so-and-so. They've kept me on my feet at times. Or maybe your takeaway today is, I can and need to be that for someone else. Lifelong friends, not saying that necessarily, but being there for them even today or this week or right now. And maybe for many of us, it means just taking a next step. Stay and have coffee in the lobby instead of racing for the parking lot. Or come up afterwards when the prayer partners are here and say, you know, I'd like someone to pray with me. I don't want to be alone with what I'm wrestling with. Or if you haven't been in a community group yet, you know, just holler at one of us, holler at me, holler at somebody and say, how do I let people know I want to be in a community group where you can be with others? It's the one thing God said, that's not good for us to be alone. You've got your Jonathans and so do I. And we get to be that for somebody else. And many of you are. And that's how God works in our lives. Shall we pray?
Thanks for listening. To find out more, please visit churchinhollywood.com.